don't let anybody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you're too arrogant. And if you don't change your ways, I will rise up and break the backbone of your power.
Otep, this is Femi, here with Freedom Now, and your ears are in tuned at high frequencies in a liberated zone. Freedom Now is a Pan-Africanist, global news outlet from coast to coast, dispelling the Western propaganda media and their all lies point of views. Freedom Now is devoted to relay true news, views, and proper clues to form solutions around freedom for the oppressed worldwide. Now, get relaxed, grab a pen, and phone a friend, because Freedom Now is set to begin to awaken deep sleepers dreaming about freedom now within. In Freedom Now, in.
Marigani. This is Sister Thade with Freedom Now's agenda for this Saturday, November 9th, 2024. This hour, prolific author, radical historian, professor of African American studies at the University of Houston, and Freedom Now co-producer, Dr. Gerald Horn interviews Dr. Bobby Smith II, associate professor of African American studies at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, and author of the book, Food, Power, Politics: The Food Story of the Mississippi Food Rights Movement. And later in the hour, Dr. Horn interviews Comrade Kalonji Jama Chunga, co-editor of Beyond Cop Cities, Dismantling Corporate Armies and Prisons. Our music clip mix includes MLK, Zap Mama, Prison Radio Commentaries. And this hour, we pay our respects and tribute to the legendary Mr. Quincy Jones, who made his transition to the ancestor world this week at the age of 91. His work and influence as a musical genius has propelled many intergenerational spaces due to the vast nature of his talent, ranging from composing, playing the trumpet and keyboard, singing, and just so much more. Rest in power, Mr. Quincy Jones. And so just sit back, phone a friend, and as always, we stand ready for revolution.
Brother, 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 there's far too many of you.
For KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Gerald Horn, and with me on the line is Bobby Smith II, Associate Professor of African American Studies at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, author of the book Food, Power, Politics: The Food Story of the Mississippi Civil Rights Movement. Thank you for joining us on Freedom Now, KPFK Los Angeles, Bobby Smith.
Thank you. Glad to be here. Thank you.
And we're glad to have you. So why did you produce this book?
So Food, Power, Politics was something that was born two different ways. So one way is I come from generations of Black farmers, Black ag workers, sharecroppers in the American South. So I've always been interested in the relationship between Black people, agriculture, and food. And this book was born while I was a graduate student at Cornell University. I was taking a class around community development and community organizing. I was already doing work around food security and things of that nature. And I took this graduate class and I read the book by Charles Payne, I've Got a Lot of Freedom. And when I read Charles Payne's book, it was the first time I'd ever encountered what became the food story of the Mississippi Civil Rights Movement. In chapter 5 of Payne's book, he talks about the way in which food entered civil rights history and how it disrupted what activists were trying to do in Mississippi. When I say disrupted, meaning that food entered the story as a disruption. Obviously, Payne's book is not about food, but my book was born out of thinking about food in the civil rights movement from the pages of Charles Payne's book, I've Got a Lot of Freedom.
So, what was sharecropping, and how was food used as a weapon against Black folk in Mississippi?
Yeah, so thinking about the rural Black experience in particular, sharecropping was an agreement. I won't say contractual because I don't want to give it that kind of characteristic. Sharecropping was an agreement between, in particular, between those who would work the land and those who owned the land. Essentially, it's an agreement where people will live on land and they would end up basically funding the whole process themselves. And then at the end of the agreement, they would get some type of money back for working the land. So they would share in getting the crop in the ground, but also making sure the crop was cultivated. And then also it was also harvested as well. And then at the end of that agreement, they would get some type of money from that particular process. It was born in the shadows of slavery. So right after slavery, around Reconstruction era in the 1800s, late 1800s, Black people who were formerly enslaved Africans who were formerly enslaved found themselves in these kind of agreements working the land because they were an agrarian people. So sharecropping is this rural experience around Black people where they were in agreement with particularly those who owned the land, and that's how they were working the land through the crops.
And so, how was food used as a weapon?
Yeah, so with sharecroppers using the land or living on the land, everything about their lives were controlled by the plantation owner or the farmer, whoever owned the land. So even their food was. So sharecroppers accessed food in three different ways. One way they did it was through what they call truck patches. So during certain crop years, sharecroppers were given a piece of land, usually on the side of their plantation shack, where they would actually grow food. During good crop years, in particular, and we're thinking about Mississippi, so we're talking about cotton. During good crop years, sharecroppers were actually asked not to, forcibly asked not to grow on the truck patch. They were asked to plant cotton or whatever the main crop was of the area. So that was one way. The second way they would do it was usually through going to plantation commissary stores. The commissary stores would allow them to get credit, but also would only allow them to buy a certain kind of foods. The third way they would do that was through what we call the federal food programs. The first one was a surplus commodities program that came out of the New Deal era in the 1930s, where Black folks would get supplemental foods or commodities for them to use to feed themselves. Also, then food stamps came in the 1960s. That's also how they accessed food. So I begin it that way because in those three ways, Black folks never were able to control when, where, and how they accessed food. Everything was conditioned on a particular agricultural economic equation, if you will. So the way in which food was used as a weapon was that when the civil rights movement came to rural places like rural parts of Mississippi, plantation owners who were also businessmen or also people who were known in their community, but be part of the civic life, they would basically withhold food from their sharecroppers if they found that they were actually participating in civil rights activism. So what we see is that in the late 1950s, early 1960s, when SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and other organizations found themselves organizing in rural Mississippi, they had to face this issue that was happening because these plantation owners or these businessmen would basically withhold food or withhold access to food, whether it's commissary stores, whether it's through the federal food programs that they control at the local level. And that's how food was used as a weapon. Food was taken away from people who were willing to fight the system.
So, what has been the significance and history of Mound Bayou, Mississippi? Was it subject to violence? Is it still in existence?
Yeah, so in chapter, I think in chapter three of my book, I talk a lot about Mound Bayou. Mound Bayou is one of the oldest independent Black towns. It was founded by formerly enslaved two men who founded it in the 1800s. And Mound Bayou was this place where people saw it as this type of paradise, if you will. I mean, a place like Mississippi, Black people went to Mound Bayou as a way to escape the violence. So there's many of stories about how people would literally be fighting, running from people or running away from particular actors, and they would find themselves running to Mound Bayou. And the minute they got to Mound Bayou, they found themselves a safe. It was safe. So it was a haven. It was a haven for Black people who were formerly enslaved, and they founded it as a way for them to produce their own independent area. Mound Bayou was subjected to violence and things of that nature, but it wasn't so much as Mound Bayou as a city was, but the people of Mound Bayou had to often go out of Mound Bayou to travel or do a number of things. So those rural people who lived right outside of Mound Bayou, so Mound Bayou also is in Bolivar County, which is about maybe about 70 miles, well, probably about 70 miles from Memphis, Tennessee, down to Blues Highway, Highway 61. And Mound Bayou was this haven. It wasn't subjected to violence as much as other Black areas in rural Mississippi, because Mound Bayou was founded, it had its own government, it had its own own county board, had its own stores, own everything. And it was a place where Black people could be somebody and be something. And the key thing about Mound Bayou is that it was an agrarian town. So Mound Bayou is not only important because of the because Black people went there as a haven and a paradise, it was a huge agricultural space for Black folks. And a lot of Black farmers still live in and around Mound Bayou because it was this place that meant so much for Black. It was founded by Black people and for Black people.
And it's still in existence.
Yeah. So Mound Bayou is still in existence, but that is always an interesting story, because when you drive down Highway 61, if you blink, you'll miss Mound Bayou. Over the years, a number of businesses have left Mound Bayou, and it looks like an abandoned town when you go through it. But Mound Bayou is still rich in their cultural history, so it's still in existence. Maybe less than 5,000 people live there now, because most people have migrated, whether to Memphis, whether to Jackson, Mississippi, whether to New Orleans, or whether to neighboring areas like Cleveland, Mississippi, Ruleville, places like that. But it's still in existence.
What is emancipatory food power?
Emancipatory food power. So my book is called, as you said before, Food Power Politics. And Food Power Politics is also the theoretical framework I used or I generated in telling this story. So food power is a concept that legal scholars, historians, and political scientists use to describe how food can be used as a weapon, how one nation withholds food from another nation in times of global conflict in particular to mitigate the impact or to ensure they have a competitive advantage during the conflict. So I use the term food power as a way to capture how food was used as a weapon against Black communities, against these rural sharecroppers that I talk about in my book. But what food power failed to do is that it failed to show me how they were responding. I was unable to at least theorize how they were responding to these actions. It's not that sharecroppers were passively sitting back and letting food be taken from them or food be weaponized against them. They also counter-weaponized food. And they did it as a way of drawing on their own agricultural experiences, their own agricultural history. And emancipatory food power is a way to capture that, because they were not using food as a way to oppress another body of people. They were using food as a way to emancipate themselves from these power struggles. So at the core of my book is a power analysis, and emancipatory food power captures what Black people were doing in response to food being used as a weapon against them.
What about the 1962 Greenwood, Mississippi food blockade? What was that about?
The Greenwood food blockade was the first time we ever saw food take center stage in the civil rights movement, both in Mississippi and also nationally. It wasn't that food was important to a number of activists in a number of areas around around the nation, but it's the first time we see food actually take a center stage for about 6 months. So it began in November 1962. So I talked about the Federal Surplus Commodities Program earlier, and that program was important again to sharecroppers. So in 1962, in LaFleur County, Mississippi, in a place called Greenwood, which was the county seat, Greenwood was once the cotton capital of the world. So Greenwood is an important part for the story of Black sharecroppers and cotton, and also civil rights. It's also in LaFleur County, which is actually the birthplace of the whites, was the headquarters of the White Citizens Council, which was Mississippi's emblematic white supremacist group. It was also the headquarters of SNCC in 1962. It was the first time SNCC came into the Yazoo, Mississippi Delta region, which is the northwest quadrant of Mississippi. So when they come to Greenwood, the LaFleur County Board of Supervisors, who's all white, this local county board, decides to dismantle the Federal Surplus Commodities Food Program in November at the end of the planting in the cotton season. This is an important time because, as I said before, this was one of the ways that black sharecroppers accessed food. So when there was no cotton crop in the ground, they depended heavily on this federal surplus commodities program. And in November 1962, the LaFleur County Board of Supervisors dismantled the program as a response to SNCC organizing in Greenwood, Mississippi. Activists read it as a direct, in many ways, activists read this as in direct conflict with what they were trying to do. So the Greenwood Food Blockade begins literally in November 1962, and it's in the newspaper. All the newspapers in Mississippi and some of the national newspapers cover this story that LaFleur County has withheld food from Mississippi Negroes, and that's some of the headlines you'll see in the archives and some of the newspapers. And that was the Greenwood Food Blockade. And in response to the Greenwood Food Blockade, SNCC activists created the Food for Freedom program. It was a 6-month program, and they dispatched people from all the way from California to New York, Chicago, Michigan, and there was like a food pipeline in response to the blockade. So while the blockade is this moment where the LaFleur County Supervisors withholds food from sharecroppers, these sharecroppers also organized with activists to create this Food for Freedom program, which was a national, multi-sided multi-sided food program that, of course, predated the work of the Black Panther Party and other works like that around food when food became more in focus in the late 1960s and early 1970s.
What is a food co-op, and what role does it play in your book?
In chapter 3 of my book, I write about an activist by the name of Mrs. L.C. Dorsey and the North Bolivar County Farm Cooperative. It was a food cooperative, a farm cooperative. And what they were trying to do is that they were trying to create their own local black food economy. So what they were trying to do in a co-op, essentially what they were doing with the food co-op is that basically there's no one owner in a cooperative understanding. It's all the people, it's by the people, for the people, and they all enter an agreement. So they bring their financial resources together, their agrarian resources, a number of other resources together to feed themselves. And again, the cooperative doesn't rise as just black people wanting to get together to feed themselves. They're doing this because the sharecropping system is collapsing literally in front of their faces. So in chapter 3 of my book, it begins in the late 1960s. So post Voting Rights Act of 1965, and around that same time, the sharecropping system in Mississippi is becoming highly mechanized. So a number of former sharecroppers are now jobless, and they're still living on the ruins of the plantations. So this food cooperative I write about in chapter 3 rises or is built on the ruins of the plantation. And what they were trying to do was they were literally trying to create an entire economy around producing food. And it was located in Mound Bayou, Shelby, and also Winstonville. Those are the three areas of the cooperative, literally. Those are the main places of it, but it was located in 12 communities in North Bolivar County, right north of Cleveland, Mississippi, for those who are familiar with Cleveland, Mississippi. So the food cooperative, again, is this arrangement between a community of people who decide that they're going to buy in and work cooperatively to feed themselves.
Are there any gender components in your story?
Yes. So the reason why I mentioned Mrs. L.C. Dorsey earlier is because oftentimes when we think about the story of food and agriculture in black life, right now, at least in Mississippi, Mrs. Fannie Lou Hamer, a very important activist, is usually mentioned a lot. I do draw on her work in my book, but the gender component is that what we found is that majority of these cooperatives were led by black women. And these black women were literally at the forefront. And during the years that they were the leaders, these cooperatives were highly successful. So for the North Bolivar County Farm Cooperative, 70% of their founding board were black women. And they were former sharecroppers, former domestics, and they all wanted to take the role of feeding their community and their families. And food is often gendered or also often coded as what many people call women's work. But these women were not just getting food on the table. They were also growing the food. They were also getting the seeds. They were turning the soil and feeding their family. And they were the backbone of this black, this local black food economy I write about in chapter 3. So women are at the forefront of my book. And in chapter 3, I take the time to really get into that because they take their roles as mothers beyond just this idea of taking care of their children, but seeing themselves as mothers over the entire community and entire area.
Now, I understand that the U.S. Department of Agriculture has just settled litigation with black farmers. resulting in a multi-million, if not multi-billion dollar judgment to these black farmers. Did this impact Mississippi at all?
So yes and no. And I say yes and no because majority of those, particularly those farmers out of places like North Carolina, Alabama, Georgia, parts of North Florida, Tennessee, parts of the Black Belt region of the state, which would be literally those states I named, and parts of Louisiana, Texas, and Arkansas. So something to say is that judgment played a major role in a number of black farmers getting settlements. Some of them were also in Mississippi in the Delta region, but majority of them are more so in the deeper Black Belt going towards Alabama. What's interesting about that particular case is that while of course the USDA was found guilty of discrimination against black farmers, what we do know is that a number of them, like, because there were so many people that actually were part of the lawsuit, the money that many people were given or are going to get is just enough money for them to break even. So many of them are going to essentially get out of farming at some point because of years of discrimination. Getting money is good for them, but it's not enough for them to stay in operation long term. And many of them are older now because this litigation started like in the 1980s. And now finally, we had Pickford Glickman in the 90s, and that case was really important. One of the first times we saw the USDA be indicted at that level. But now we're having more and more conversations because even though that happened in the 90s, the USDA is still not righted its wrongs against black farmers.
Finally, Bobby Smith, the second Associate Professor of African American Studies at the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana, author of the book Food Power Politics, The Food Story of the Mississippi Civil Rights Movement. What's next on your agenda?
I am actually interested in thinking about the next generation of black farmers and black agricultural professionals. In chapter 4 of my book, I write about black youth and how black youth in Mound Bayou, actually, thank you. I'm now thinking about it. In Mound Bayou, these black youth are thinking about how to take care of their community today through the production of food. So I'm interested in really keeping that line of thinking going and thinking about this historically. What we do know is that black youth have always been at the forefront of a number of social movements. We talked about SNCC. We talk about a number of student organizations in the 1960s. At the same time, there were a number of black youth who were also interested in going into agriculture to become soil scientists, to become farmers, to become black agriculture professionals. So my next project is dabbling in some of the histories around black youth in agricultural organizations, building on chapter 4 of my book, the last chapter of my book.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, Professor Smith. Thank you for joining us on Freedom Now, KPFK, Los Angeles.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank you, Dr. Horn.
And up next, our prison radio commentary.
Bariki Hall, maestra of music. Her name was Bariki Hall Shabazz, but I knew her as Maestra, my music teacher. Her community knew her as Sister Bariki, or Mama Bariki, a black woman who was truly, as the saying goes, black on both sides. She lived her blackness by joining and supporting a wealth of black organizations. She was a self-described foot soldier in the now famous National Black Political Convention in Gary, Indiana. She also supported the Congress of African People, the Republic of New Africa, the Black Radical Congress in Cobra, and the annual Congressional Black Caucus. She lived her blackness by singing and playing organ in her local church and as a performer with the Mary Caldwell Dawson Pittsburgh chapter of the National Association of Negro Musicians, where she sang as a soprano soloist. Sister Bariki loved music and performed on the stage as a professional, and shared with me the story of wondering if this work helped free our people. When she found it didn't, she left the stage. Bariki lived her blackness by loving black people. In October 2023, she was honored for her long-term support for the Functional Literacy Ministry of Haiti, which provides education, literacy training, healthcare, and trade skills to Haiti's people. As a child, she spent extensive time with her grandparents, who shared stories and memories of their captivity on the R.J. Reynolds plantation in North Carolina. She learned as a child what it meant to be black in America. She was a teenager when the world learned about the brutal torture and murder of Emmett Till, the child from Chicago who went to Money, Mississippi and was allegedly slain for whistling at a white woman. These events made Sister Bariki into a woman of strong will, determination, and deep compassion for the struggles of black people. Her friend, Martha Conley, introduced us, and after a discussion about music, offered her musical services when I said I regretted not being able to read music. So, for the next few years, Sister Bariki was my musical maestra, who brought flashcards, musical scores, and coached me on the do re mi scale. She made music make sense to me. I am forever indebted to my teacher, my maestra, Sister Bariki. Sister Bariki Hall Shabazz lived her blackness by raising a family of loving, conscious black people, most of whom attended and graduated from historically black colleges and universities. She is survived by her loving family, Dr. John R. Diggs, Jr., Khadija Tamu Diggs, Esquire, Malika E. Hall, and Delili T. Hall. She has three granddaughters, Kamaya Diggs, Makeda Diggs, and Savita Diggs. In her own words, Sister Bariki said, quote, "If anyone should ever think of me, do so in the attitude of my having been a long time dedicated foot soldier in the army of my Lord," unquote.
This is Sister Flora, and you are listening to Freedom Now at KPFK 90.7 FM in occupied Mexico, including Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM in San Diego, and streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. Today's program, as well as 10 prior editions, can be reheard at kpfk.org/audio archive, and scroll down to Freedom Now. From 12 to 1 p.m., following Freedom Now, is our Sister Assumpta, with Spotlight Africa addressing issues facing Mother Africa. For a truly alternative international perspective on world affairs, check out RTTV Russia, CCTV China, and online at Presna, Latina Cuba, Telesur, Venezuela. News 24, South Africa, and Press TV, Iran. And up next, our prison radio commentary.
A call for justice. Leonard Peltier's release. Hello, this is Donald C. Note Hooker, foundational Black American, prison artist, and advocate for justice. Today, I want to speak about Leonard Peltier, a man who, like me, will face the parole board in 2026. By that time, I will have spent 29 years in prison, and Leonard will have been incarcerated for over 50 years. This isn't about asking for mercy, it's about following the law. Leonard was sentenced to life with the possibility of parole, not life without parole, and certainly not the death penalty. keeping him in prison at 80 years old when he poses no threat to anyone is illegal. The law doesn't allow the government to slow walk a man to death through repeated parole denials. Leonard's continued imprisonment is not about justice, it's about revenge, and that has no place in our legal system. COINTELPRO, the FBI's illegal program designed to dismantle civil rights movements, played a major role in Leonard's conviction. This same program targeted leaders like Martin Luther King Jr., men whom the government labeled as threats, but whom history now celebrates. Leonard, too, was wrongfully targeted. Programs like COINTELPRO violated our First Amendment rights, and those consequences must be considered. Even today, peaceful groups like Cold Pink, an anti-war organization made up of grandmothers, has been spied on by the government simply for exercising their constitutional right to protest. When peaceful dissent is treated as a threat, we must recognize the government's overreach. Leonard Peltier, like so many others, was a victim of that overreach. Leonard is now an elderly man. I've spent decades in prison, and I've seen firsthand how elderly inmates who are too frail to harm anyone are still held behind bars. This is nothing short of state-sponsored elderly abuse. The parole board has a legal obligation to release Leonard. This is not about mercy, it's about following the law. Black and Native Americans share a history of systematic oppression. Neither of us share the same immigration origin narrative as other Americans. Native Americans were here long before European settlers, and Black Americans were brought here in chains. Leonard's imprisonment is another chapter in that long history of injustice, and it's time for the government to right this wrong. Leonard Peltier was promised the possibility of parole, and now the government must honor that. This is not a plea for forgiveness, it's a demand for legality. It's time for the U.S. Parole Commission and the Department of Justice to parole Leonard Peltier and end this injustice. Thank you.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
We will now continue with historian Professor Dr. Gerald Horn.
For Pacifica Radio, KPFK Los Angeles, this is Gerald Horn, and with me on the line is Kalonji Jama Changa, co-editor of Beyond Cop Cities, Dismantling Corporate Funding, Armies, and Prisons. Thank you for joining us on Freedom Now, KPFK, Comrade Kalonji.
It is an honor and it's a pleasure, Comrade Gerald Horn.
Right on. So why did you produce this book?
Well, this book, it stems from a number of different interviews that we put together on RSTV, Black Power Media, and also writings that Dr. Joy James and I had produced for a number of different publications, including Harvard's Inquest magazine and I believe Truth Out and a couple others that come to mind. And this actually was her idea in regards to making it a book. We knew that Cop City, it is a growing phenomenon, not just in Atlanta, but, you know, across the U.S. And, you know, we wanted to kind of tap into, you know, the whole idea, because we know that Cop City is not a new thing. We know that it stems from you know, militarized policing. It stems from the military itself. But at the same time, you know, I like to say there's no cop city. It's just a police state, period. But this is what it's called. So, you know, we kind of, you know, decided to jump in and give a give perspective. And that's kind of what happened.
Now, my understanding is that the Cop City struggle in Atlanta centered around building of a major fortress for the police department, and it envisioned fortifying the police department with a certain number of powers. Is that a fair rendition, and do you have anything else to add to that?
Yeah, I would say that, yes, it is. It's definitely a fair rendition. And I think that, again, it's a we're looking at it's a corporate funded project. You know, it is a, you know, it's what secular states use to maintain hegemony, not just in the United States, but again, internationally. So it is a microcosm of a macrocosm, you know. So we know that, you know, with over 900 military bases across the world, we know that in order to maintain wars domestically, there has to be a level of training that has to be up because of the fact that we know that, you know, there is there's a concerted effort to maintain domination as a whole. So I think that Cop Cities is a necessary base or small barrack or military base or whatever, paramilitary compounds that you know, that any quote unquote intelligent in any intelligent imperialist would use, you know. So that's how we kind of see it.
Now, my understanding is that military materiel is transferred from the Pentagon to U.S. cities. Would this be flashlights, grenade launchers, sandbags, tanks, all of the above? Anything else?
I would say all of the above, but I think that the thing is, when you talk about, again, you know, the Pentagon, and you talk about the military and the police, of course, the police are the, you know, the military arm of, you know, of the local military arm. And not only are these supplies that you mentioned transported from the U.S., I mean, excuse me, from the Pentagon, the actual training itself goes not just from the U.S. military, but as we pointed out in the book, you know, training from abroad by, you know, Israeli soldiers. Here in Atlanta, they have what's called the GILI program. And GILI is the Georgia International Law Enforcement Exchange. And the GILI program, over the past 31 years, police here in Georgia have been training in Israel, in Jerusalem in particular, around, you know, with their military. They actually send out top brass Georgia police officers who learn different tactics. And this has been going on for the past 30 plus years. So not only is it tied, you know, to what's going on in the Pentagon, not only is supplying weapons, but it's an international concerted effort. And we like to draw the line, not just because of the fact that folks just look at Cop Cities and they're like, okay, well, this is something in Atlanta. It's just this over $100 million project that that's just taking place because, you know, they want to, you know, I don't know, have a playground for police officers. When in fact, this is, it is about domestic imperialism. And this training, not only, you know, it's not only conducted by military forces here and Israelis, so on and so forth, but we would make the connection to the School of Americas, because a lot of these same folks come out of that particular camp. And the same policing that takes place here in the U.S., of course, it takes place in the Caribbean, Latin America, and, you know, all over the planet. So it's tied in beyond, and that's why we say it's beyond Cop Cities. It's not just, you know, a local thing. And I know that folks have been, you know, talking about how Cop Cities are sprouting out across America, and they have this campaign to stop Cop City. But the reality is, when you look at Cop Cities, particularly here in Atlanta, you know, this is something that's been, it's been 10, 15 years in the making. You know, so we're just getting on board. And to me, if there's a Cop Cities or not, you know, it's not going to slow down the murders, the over 1,500 murders of citizens here in the United States yearly, you know, by the various police departments, you know, across the country. So, you know, for the record, myself, even though I'm in Atlanta, I didn't spend much time on the ground protesting, because of the fact that I understand that there are a number of different components. Again, not just police agencies, not just the Atlanta Police Foundation, which is the local union here, but major corporations. You're not fighting a war against the city of Atlanta. You're not even fighting a war against the state of Georgia. You're fighting, imperialism. You're up against a paramilitary force.
Now, what you've said thus far suggests an implicit, if not explicit, tie between war abroad, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Gaza, and war at home. Could you speak to that question?
I think what we have to realize, war is war. And when you're talking about domination, when you're talking about death and destruction, it's a part of a war machine. So indeed, as we know, oftentimes there are military personnel, there are soldiers who come back from war and they become local police officers. And, with that, they utilize the same tactics and training. So these particular trained enforcers, they see the folks locally as insurgents in these communities they don't live in when they go to serve them. So yes, tying in, and we've had, we've seen footage of, some of the Cop City training where they're actually going to places like Jerusalem. So when you talk about the tie-in between like Iraq and Afghanistan and even places like the Sudan and places like, the whole Ukraine-Russia conundrum, we recognize it holistically, because these same soldiers, like I said, are training individuals locally. So the tie-in, again, it's about full spectrum war, full control. And if we look at it from the way the American medical system looks at it, if we don't look at it holistically, we can fight a symptom, but that's not going to stop the disease. And the disease is white supremacy. The disease is hegemony. It's imperialism. And it's the way of the world. These are the same soldiers. Again, these are local soldiers. I think that one thing we don't look at, we have to say, what is the role of police here in the United States? The role of police here in the United States is the same role of the international police, which is the military. It's to maintain control. It's maintain domination. And until we look at it holistically, we'll continue to run on this wheel like a lab mouse or something. And we'll just keep running around in circles and running around in circles until one day there's none of us left to run around anywhere. So it is a international prison that's being built. So to your question, I know I went all the way around the world. Indeed, it is absolutely tied from top to bottom.
Well, just as a footnote to what you just articulated, some years ago, I did a book about the liberation struggle in Zimbabwe. And the racist minority regime in Southern Africa was fortified post-1975 with the arrival of embittered Euro-American soldiers who had just been defeated in Vietnam and then came to Southern Africa to try to prevent African liberation. Right now, I'm working on a book that deals with the post-U.S. Civil War, post-1865, when Confederate, that is to say, pro-enslaving forces, migrated en masse to Egypt, where they spearheaded an invasion of Ethiopia a few years later, which had as a purpose the enslaving of East Africans who could then be transported to slave markets in Turkey, now Turkey. So it seems that the sooner we recognize the inevitable tie between the domestic and the global, will always be outnumbered and outgunned. Which brings me to the next question, the Stop Cop City movement. Talk to us about that movement and tell us, in particular, does it have support from unions?
You know, in regards to the Top City movement, I think that there are some sincere forces. I think that there are some, and I was actually a part of a national Top City convening just last month. And you have some sincere forces, like most movements and struggles do. But I think that one of the things that is lacking is a clear and concrete politic. I think that the political education around Cop City, I think that there is a lack, because to me, you know, it is in need, in desperate need of strategy. And I think that sometimes folks believe that this fight, you know, we can shout them down like the walls of Jericho. We have to understand, again, that we are up against now the Biden administration, which, like all U.S. administrations, have funded apartheid and occupation of places like Palestine. Of course, you know, they funded mercenaries to maintain apartheid South Africa. You know, the U.S. has funded the violent death of thousands of Palestinians after the Hamas situation last year, the October 2023 piece. And it's you know, it's an ongoing situation. So I think that the Cop City movement, while I believe it means well, I believe that, again, there are some very sincere forces who I respect and I honor, and many of them I love. But I think that it's a lack of a coherent, you know, plan, because I think that folks confuse. You know, being angry and being upset as some type of as an action. I think sometimes folks believe that we can protest this away. They believe that we can shout it away. They believe we can you know, put together petitions, you know, and when you're dealing with violent oligarchy, when you're dealing with individuals who are hell-bent on the destruction of the planet, because Cop City is one of the things that we appreciate, is that there are environmentalists involved who understand that here we are in Georgia, the most forested city in America, and they're chopping down hundreds of acres to build a military base in essence. So to the question of unions supporting it, you know, the only unions that we know of are the unions that are against this situation, and that would be the police unions themselves. Now, if there are other unions that are backing it right now at this time, I don't know anything about that. But, you know, like I said, the main union is the Atlanta Police Foundation. And these are the people who are funding and aiding in the destruction of not only, again, people, citizens, but, you know, the environment and ultimately the planet. So, again, it's that small microcosm of the macrocosm.
Hmm. Who was Tortuguita?
Tortuguita was a young environmentalist, and he was, were in the forest. You have a number of different, you know, defenders, forest defenders, and he was one of the forest defenders who was violently murdered, Manuel Tortuguita Esteban Paez Herran, 26-year-old. You know, and he simply was, you know, protesting, you know, the destruction of these ancestral forests. They claimed that he fired a gun at an officer. This was in January of 2023. You know, but what ended up happening was there was a private autopsy. And in that private autopsy, they found that Tortuguita had been sitting cross-legged on the ground with their hands raised when Georgia troopers shot them 57 times. You know, they riddled Tortuguita's body with bullets. A Georgia State trooper was shot and injured, and we're pretty certain that that was friendly fire from another police officer. You know, so after the murder of this young person, public information was found that showed that that the shooting, that police that were involved in the shooting started to distribute flyers in the neighborhood where one of the officers lived, and the police jailed organizers that were distributing the information, and police ended up jailing some of them for stalking and felony intimidation. This was after Tortuguita's death. These young folks decided to protest in this neighborhood, and the mere act of protesting, the mere act of saying this is disgusting that you've murdered our comrade and our friend, and it's this young individual, they decided to ramp up this terroristic act.
So what has been the upshot? Is the struggle continuing around this death?
I think that for many of us, we look at Tortuguita for what Tortuguita is and was, and simply, he's a casualty. They are a casualty of war, and it has to be fought holistically. So his name is raised, and his mother, I believe she's in Panama, if I'm not mistaken. I interviewed her last year on my show. But, I think that, folks are continuing to fight in Tortuguita's name. But again, holistically, we have to remember Tortuguita as we remember George Floyd, as we remember Sean Bell, as we remember Abner Luima, who was sodomized in New York, as we remember Oscar Grant over on the West Coast where you are, and as we remember the brothers and sisters who are being slaughtered currently in the Sudan, those in the Congo, those in Haiti, who the U.S. has a vested interest in dominating and destroying that particular country and the people there, and and utilizing, the as you talked about earlier, some of the connections, utilizing the Kenyan soldiers to attack their own brothers and sisters in the name of getting paid, just saying it what it is. And of course, we've heard reports recently that they hadn't received a check yet for that, but they are running dogs for the state. And we know that it's, again, that connection is, that we utilize this wherever we are. The unfortunate thing about Atlanta, Georgia, they say it's the Black Mecca. And the only thing that we can have in common with a Mecca is that it's a desert. So it is indeed a Black Mecca, but it's not, and as our brother and comrade, the Ruba Ben Wahab, will point out, the slaves run the plantation here. So, as you can see, when you look at the protesters of Cop City, it's been others that have kind of dominated that particular piece. And I think part of that issue is because Africans here in Atlanta, they know full well that with or without a Cop City, their communities are already occupied. They're already under attack. They're already under assault. They have a police dog now. They got police robots and all that other stuff. So the thing is, it is a testing ground. It is a place where there's over 20,000 cameras just on the streets of Atlanta. But yet it doesn't deter crime. It doesn't deter, this militarized policing. It's business as usual. And whenever anything happens, no one knows anything. That camera wasn't working, or, whatever the case is. But yeah, indeed, it is, Tortuguita's name, will continue to be held, because, there's another life loss.
Are there any gender components of this Stop Cop City movement?
Gender components in regards to...
Well, is there any was there a representation of women in the movement or feminists in the movement? Is there a disproportionate impact upon Black men, for example, with regard to this increase in police terrorism, for example?
Right. No, I would say it would be fair to say that there are all types of gender involvement. I would say that, you know, there are, and that's, I think that's a beautiful thing that you have all types of individuals with who identify in whatever way, fashion, or form that they do, you know, who have been participating in this war against terror. You know, because they understand that we are the victims of war and terror. We're not the terrorists. But at the same time, of course, we know that, you know, as far as the victims themselves, you know, it definitely, you know, it's, I believe it would be fair to say that, of course, there's been more Black men killed, more Black people as a whole, Black men, women, children, etc. You know, so, you know, I would chalk it as that. But like I said, as far as folks who are participating in that fight, you know, it is, I think it would be safe to say that in many cases, it's all hands on deck. And remember that Cop Cities is not just in Atlanta, you know, it is, you know, across the U.S. right now. And, you know, of course, it's been across the U.S. because, you know, I for one, I don't even like the name Cop Cities. You know, I'm, you know, again, it's a police state. And I think that, you know, every now and then we come up with, you know, different terms and phrases, so on and so forth. But, you know, you can call it cocky, you can call it feces, and you can call it something else that I'm not going to say on your show, but it's the same old stuff.
Mm. Finally, you know, Comrade Kalanji, co-editor of the book Beyond Cop Cities, Dismantling Corporate-Funded Armies and Prisons, I understand you have a YouTube channel. Talk to us about that and how interested audience members can follow you.
Right on. So first and foremost, I would like to start with the most important thing by saying I am a one of the founders of FTP Movement, which is my organization. I am a quote unquote activist first. I'm a organizer first. So I will always want to point that out because I don't ever want to be thought of as just this or just that. Not that any of that stuff is unimportant, but I want folks to recognize that, you know, the tradition I come in. But yes, I'm the co-founder of Black Power Media, and it can be found at Black Power Media Reloaded on YouTube, Black Power Media Reloaded. And we've had a ton of great guests, including yourself, and hopefully we can get you back on soon. You know, and folks like, you know, the Daruba Benwahas, the Cornel Wests, and the Dr. Joy Jameses, and, you know, so many others have come through and supported, you know, what it is we've been attempting to do. Black Power Media is a little over 3 years old right now. And, you know, we're constantly growing and we appreciate the opportunity to, you know, speak with folks who are smarter than us, as my father would say.
I see. Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, Comrade Kalanji. Thank you for joining us on Freedom Now, KPFK, Los Angeles.
Thank you, sir.
And in closing, we'd like to thank our guest. Thank you, Professor Bobby Smith. Thank you, Comrade Kalanji Jamachanga. Thank you to our co-producers, Dr. Gerald Horn, Sister Flora, Sister Femi, Brother Brandon, and all those who made today's program possible. Thank you to our board op Wendell and Michael Novick for your support. Please stay tuned for our sister Assumpta coming up next with Spotlight Africa, addressing issues facing Mother Africa. Signing off for Freedom Now, this is Sister Thage, and until next week, as always, we stand ready for revolution.
We state these facts only to let you know that those of us who are revolutionary, Pan-Africanists, is not because we love revolution. It is historically determined, and we have no alternative but to follow history and to use history for the benefit of our people.